Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we profile local jazz musician Tom Painter. We learn about the newest inductees into the Toy Hall of Fame, find out about a new local interdisciplinary art critiquing group, and we visit a small candy kitchen in Galena. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. If you're an artist, any kind of artist, chances are you spend a lot of time alone. After all, it's almost certain that you're not rich, and much of your work is done in solitude. But part of the fun of being an artist is showing your work to other people, and then hearing what they think. That's the purpose of a series of sessions in the Champaign-Urbana area, sponsored by the Cranard Art Museum and the local Arts Council 40 North 88 West. It's show and tell for artists, as Jim Meadows discovered when he visited a recent meeting in the Call to Arts series.
Okay, let's maybe you could pull over some chairs over here. You just take a chair.
Artist Jerry Savage helps set up chairs in the gigantic living room of his home in rural Sydney. Paintings from his 40-year career as an artist hang on the walls. But that's not what's brought the dozen or so guests to Savage's home. They're here to see each other's work, starting with Charlie Westman of Urbana.
I'm Charlie Westman. I'm a physician, actually. I don't have any real art training, and I do sort of concept-driven. I like to make boxes, and I'll show you. This one is about information. I'm glad Jerry is...
Charlie is showing off a box he calls the Writer's Companion. The lid is decorated with examples of communication stopped dead in their tracks. A braille message encased in plastic so it can't be felt, a compact disc, which can't be removed for playing, and the image of the Rosetta Stone, representing dead languages. Open the lid, and you'll see the impermanence of communications on display, refrigerator poetry magnets, a chalkboard, and a notepad with pages waiting to be torn off and thrown away.
But the guts of it is I had an old paper shredder that stripped its gears, so I decided to do something with it, and I figured this is sort of the artist's companion. You put your ideas there, and then you can take them straight to trash. And this is an erasable.
The people laughing at Charlie Westman's paper shredder in a box are taking part in A Call to Arts, a monthly art critique session where local artists can show off their work and get feedback from other artists. Some of the feedback Charlie gets focuses on his preferred form, the box.
We're outside of it, whereas your ideas are all inside of the box, and they're saying something. Does that bother you that we are sort of not interacting visually or emotionally, except by looking at the details?
What you see when you first see it is not all what you get. You know, the idea is that there are things you interact with. These aren't wall pieces. They're things to be picked up and held and opened up.
Jerry Savage wraps up the critique on Westman's box with praise for how it explores its subject matter. But
I like to see him perhaps take a little more chances with materials, be more intuitive about materials, because the materials are handled in sort of a conventional way when you compare it to the complexity of the subject matter of his work. Now, when you're into materials, it's an entryway into your own psyche, because you don't think about it. You just sort of play with it, move back and forth, slowly discover more about your sort of tactile sense, visual sense of yourself.
The Call to Art session at Savage's home was the second one held this season. The series is organized by Jenny Southland, who invites all sorts of creative people to attend, from painters to writers to dancers.
I knew that a lot of artists felt very isolated and really wanted to get together and talk about work and the content of work and the struggles they were having as artists. And it was just a way to bring people together to get feedback on their work. And I liked interdisciplinary because, for me, painters just talking about painting becomes kind of intellectually incestuous.
There were no writers or dancers showing their work at this particular session, but there was Alan Vandeveer, who manipulates his drawings, paintings, and photos with a computer, and then uses the computer image as the basis for his final work. One of those in attendance had questions about the role the computer played in Vandeveer's creative process.
If you painted in the traditional way, you'd have the canvas, you may gesso it, you work up from the whole canvas, and at some point your work is resolved. But through this electronic medium, you're sharing that process, that creative process, with Photoshop, and Photoshop has certain limitations to it in addition to the wide range of possibilities it has. And so I'm wondering, how you feel about sharing that creative process with Photoshop, because in a way, Photoshop is your co-artist.
I disagree. I see it just as a tool. I just see it as a tool, but a tool that has, like, all the colors, you know, and that. I mean, I don't have to worry about running out white, I don't have to run out blue.
Unlike Charlie Westman, Vandeveer has art school training. He says the critiques he received at A Call to Arts were a little more tactful than what he might receive from fellow students.
In a classroom, people are much more, I wouldn't say honest, well, honest in a way, but hard, harsh. It's criticism, you know, and there's, you know, people will be tell you that they hate it or they don't like a certain part. We're here, it's a little more friendly. I mean, I'm assuming that we don't know each other well enough to really go hardcore on each other about our work.
Do people get too mean in a classroom critique, or do people get too nice in this setting?
Too nice in this setting. I like the harshness personally. In the classroom, I've seen people not like what people have said about their work.
Elizabeth Simmons, a graphic artist just getting into painting, says she has experience with art school critique sessions too, but she also appreciated the feedback she received when she showed some of her still lives at the Call to Art session.
These critiques are very interesting because there's a wide variety of both professional artists and amateur artists who attend, and it opens the critique up in a much different way than if it were strictly a group of professional artists. And I think that sometimes it's more surprising that way because we do have amateur artists that are participating.
Jenny Southland wants both amateurs and professionals to attend the sessions.
What we do hope is that people do bring work and that those that come not to be an audience but genuinely come to engage and participate. And, of course, you know, we have a social time, either a break, so that artists can connect and, you know, who knows, create collaborations. My interest has always been to empower individuals in this community, particularly artists.
Southland says she makes sure the Call to Arts critique sessions are held at locations that are artist-friendly, whether at private homes, galleries, or other locations. They're scheduled through May, always on the third Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. The next one is December 15th at the Verde Gallery in downtown Champaign. 40 North has more information on their website at www.40north.org. I'm Jim Meadows.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Champaign-Urbana has always been known for its vibrant music community, in particular its collection of innovative jazz musicians. Sidetrack's Steffi Chung profiles one of them.
Toes point. Arms reach up and then release. A man walks in. The bright fluorescent light catches the white and grays of his hair. His eyes focus through thick lenses. He looks to the left diagonal corner of the room. He doesn't pay much attention to the dancers as he goes straight for the old grand piano. The weight of the two drums he hugs under each arm gives a kind of syncopation to his walk. Pulling out the bench, he takes his place. While the dancers warm up, Thomas Painter is drawing out utensils from a backpack. Playing for modern dance classes is just one of the many projects he does. He's a Renaissance musician. He composes. He plays with various ensembles in town, like with his band Ear Doctor, and volunteers at the community radio station WEFT. He places the two drums to the right of his bench. Next, he takes out an hourglass-looking instrument, the dunebeck, and puts it between his legs. On top of the dunebeck, he places a tambourine. Now, with instruments in hand, he watches the dancers before making a stroke on the keys. He is looking for the character of the dance.
Is this heavy or light? Is there a lot of motion? Is the whole body moving, or is it confined to just moving limbs and neck? Does it look sad or happy or, fast or slow, smooth or sharp? You know, all those things will sort of cue what you should come up with, and oftentimes you may only have 20 or 30 seconds to think of something, so you develop certain shticks or sort of bags that you can get into and out of, and within those you can have variations which are more interactive in real time with the dancer, such that part of your music is sort of on autopilot and then another part is more in the moment.
Experimenting with various techniques in color and contrast, Painter paints through his music. The music becomes part of the dance. Putting Painter to the test, connecting what he's playing to the movements of the dancers. There's a certain playfulness in Painter's mischievous yo-yo song. Between pieces, Painter pulls out an Altoid box. Inside are clothespins and old screws.
It's called preparing the piano, and what you do is insert various objects between and on the strings, and clothespins work very nicely because they're softer than the strings and hence won't damage or detune the piano if you do it correctly. And then I also use a soft brass screw, and these can be placed at various lengths along the string, and so you'll get different overtones coming out. It has kind of a music boxy sound. Often I'll tune a mode or part of a scale within a certain octave or two of the piano with clothespins, so that'll be my music box section of the piano. Of course, the screws in the lower end, you can get more like gong-like sounds. One of the things I always think about is this boring the students or something? Because oftentimes we'll have repeated exercises in dance, either in the course of the day or over the course of the semester. So you want to provide a solid framework for the dancers, and yet there's a fine line between playing solid and just playing kind of monotonously. So I try not to make it boring. I try and keep it fresh by altering some aspect of what I'm doing, or even changing instruments, you know, in a dance class in the middle of an exercise just to give a different musical perspective on the movement.
The class ends. Painter's about to leave on his bike, ready to play more music. He's found a home in Champaign-Urbana as a musician.
There's enough opportunities for performing, and the venues I play don't sort of pigeonhole you into one style of music, so there's enough variety, and maybe not a critical mass, but enough people playing and enjoying the music to make it worth it.
It's a Sunday night at the Iron Post in Urbana. Lights hush to soft yellows and smoky oranges. Painter in his signature gray vest over flannel shirt sits at one of the round tables facing the small stage. He fires up a cigarette, draws in deep, and exhales.
I don't go with the intention of playing any particular piece, rather go and just interact with some fellow musicians in the community and see what they have to play.
Here, everyone knows Painter. Painter is sitting in at a jazz jam session with the Paradox, a local jazz band in town. Throughout the night, he'll get up to play the flute or the piano. During his piano solos, he closes his eyes as he plays, blotting in counting rhythms, coloring in chords, sketching arpeggios, brushing crescendos and diminuendos as he sinks his fingers deep into the keys.
I had a teacher that said, what is good music is music that warrants and rewards contemplation. So it's its own justification in my world. It's just my modus operandi now, and I really would. I think I would have a big loss in my life if I didn't do music. I would feel something missing.
He might not be as eccentric as Van Gogh, but he does have a thing for ears. Painter co-founded the local group Ear Doctor. He writes music for the band. On Monday nights, Painter occasionally carries the persona of the doctor to his radio jazz show, Mellifluous Cacophony, on WEFT.
Okay, and that last one was produced right around the corner by Mark Rubel here at Pogo Studios. So, we're still looking for our first pledge on Mellifluous Cacophony. This is Dr. Salmon Drano, asking you to put a ducat in the bucket, as it were, and give me a call at 359. Dr. Salmon Drano, yes. He is part of the Ear Doctor mythocracy, and it's just sort of an on-mic name that I use occasionally, may whip it out for pledge drive or whatever for a little extra color. But he is said doctor and ear doctor, so Dr. Salmon Drano.
As for the doctor part, he's got that covered. Painter got his PhD at the University of Chicago for music composition, but his friends might think of him a different way.
Probably as some type of freak that writes music that's too hard for them to play or something, I don't know. I think I just try and play music that would warrant and reward listening to. So I try and play something that is interesting in some way, and it's for anyone who wants to listen, basically.
He doesn't describe his affair with music as love.
It's more of an intrigue, a fascination, and a desire to work with all these materials that I've been exploring, and it just continues to be a satisfying form of activity. I'm content now, I would say. We'll see what it, I think I just have to keep doing what I'm doing and persist, and hopefully something good will come out of it.
With all he does, Painter's still got canvases to fill. For Sidetrack, I'm Steffi Chung.
This is Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. Are you, or is someone you know, a Yankneck? How about a Hexpatriot? A WB? Holodork? If you don't know what these are, don't worry. They're all explained in the new book by Robert Lanham called Food Court Druids, Cherahonkies, and Other Creatures Unique to the Republic. It's published by Plume Books. We last talked to Lanham in March 2003 after the publication of The Hipster Handbook. When I got him on the phone this time, I asked him how this new book came to be.
I got the idea when the term metrosexual was floating around in the media, and it's the metrosexual being an archetype that people seem to recognize, but just hadn't been given a name yet. And started thinking to myself that, hey, maybe I should write a book with maybe 100 other types of recognizable people that just haven't been classified yet. And there you go. You have the new book.
Well, we do like our labels, and we do like our categories as a culture.
Yeah, I think we do.
And it is funny, because when you read through this, and you know it's a humorous book, and you know it's satire, but you read through this, and you say, I know that person.
Yeah.
And well, you can put names to the categories.
I really enjoy watching people, and I think, I think there are some, obvious jokes that I have in the book, but for the most part, I just kind of presented people as they were, and it seems like people in their element are kind of humorous in and of themselves, myself included. I think we're all neurotic, and I think if you just kind of present reality as is, it's probably funnier than if you made something up.
Well, why don't we talk about the people you present in the title, the Food Court Druids and the Cherahonkies.
Yeah, the Food Court Druid is kind of a subcategory of a goth. For some reason, I always find these people at the food courts, thus the name, but it seems like kids that are obsessed with Marilyn Manson and seem to get their wardrobe inspiration from the Dungeons & Dragons Player's Handbook. Maybe they wear snake eye contact lenses and, try to look like druids. The Cherahonkie is a white baby boomer who dresses like a Native American. Seems like there's a lot of those in the Southwest. I just got back from Maine recently and saw a lot of waspy-looking women wearing turquoise jewelry. And seems like, just kind of off a little bit because almost a fish-out-of-water type of person.
Well, you introduced this phrase in your book, or this, field of study, called idiosyncrology.
Yeah, that's very well established field of study. It's idiosyncrology is the study of idiosyncratic people, and throughout the book I give each category of person that I classify an idio rank, which qualifies how bizarre they are, basically. A 1 being the most sane, whereas a 10 being the strangest, probably.
So give us some examples of some other profiles, some other character types that you've featured in this book.
Yeah, one that really seems to be resonating with people is the stretchabitionist, which is, if you've ever been to the gym, you've probably seen some of these people. It's usually middle-aged women that doesn't seem like they're really working out. They're just there to stretch provocatively, and they usually have breast enhancement. And it seems like every gym in the country has the stretchabitionist. After the most recent election, another very popular one is the Hexpatriot, which is people that aren't happy with their politics, or government rather, and but they never actually leave the country. They just complain about leaving the country and say that they're if we have another 4 years like the last, I'm moving.
Well, I have a couple that I enjoy from the book, mm-hmm. including the WB.
The WB. Oh, I think my sister's a WB, actually.
Yeah, explain what that is.
A WB is someone who really identifies with a character from Bugs Bunny. And it seems like the two most popular WBs that I know of are people that really associate with or really identify with the Tasmanian Devil, and people that really identify with Marvin the Martian. And with people that wear Tasmanian Devil clothing, it seems like they think they're kind of wild and crazy and maybe the life of the party, whereas people that identify with Marvin the Martian, it seems like they probably think they're eccentric and kind of wacky, from a different world, kind of like Marvin is.
And there's another one called Yanknecks.
Yankneck. Yeah, Yankneck is, wow, I just got back from Maine, so this was strange to actually see some of these people, but rednecks that don't live in the South. I saw a lot of rebel flags on, waving in people's front lawns up in Maine, and I was like, do these people think that the South is going to rise again? It's really strange when you see that outside of the South. And I think you can find Yanknecks. They don't have to be Yankee country necessarily, because anyone that's not from the South to a true redneck is a Yankee.
And there's another one that I think fits very well with this time of year, the Holodorks.
Holodork, yeah. I think everyone has a family member that's a Holodork. It's just people that dress up no matter what season it is with season-themed clothing. You know, if your mom or your dad has the Frosty the Snowman sweater that they like to wear all throughout December, then they're probably a Holodork.
Well, I'm reading through this, and I'm wondering, first of all, how you develop these sort of satiric profiles, and when you develop them and you start putting them down on paper, is there a point when you say, I've gone too far and this is just mean? You know, where do you draw that line between fun? Because, you know, there's a little bit of biting satire in here, of course, but it doesn't go over that edge of just being absolutely vicious.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty even-handed. It comes back to, you know, not really exaggerating people, but just kind of presenting them as is. And I think if you're satirical all across the board, I think, you know, I make fun of everything from hipster culture to not-so-hip culture. And I think we live in an age where, you know, people are so afraid after the Janet nipple to write anything or to say anything that's a little bit racy. I think people are actually really warming up to this book because it is a little bit racy, and I think everybody will see themselves in it as well, and or friends that they know and family members, and get a kick out of it. And I think I'm probably the strangest person that's in the book. I qualify myself as an idiosyncrologist and someone who's obsessed with categorizing other people. So what's more neurotic than that?
Now, are there any groups that you had to leave out, groups that are on the cutting room floor?
I have some in mind for the follow-up, so hopefully there'll be another idiosyncrological study. But we'll have to see. And I have a site called foodcourtdruids.com where I'm inviting people to come and recommend new idiotypes, as I call them. And I've had a good response to that, probably 30 or 40 other recommendations that people have been coming to the site and saying, hey, you know, my brother is this, or my brother is, or my sister is that. And it seems like people really enjoy coming up with these classifications. And it's been a fun project to work on.
Well, it makes me wonder, with all these classifications you've come up with and the more that seem to be coming up with every minute, is anybody really normal?
I don't think so, and that's why I really enjoy watching people. I think that's what makes people interesting. And with the book, I think, people are generally classified as being black or white or Republican or Democrat, and with this book, I think what's interesting about it is it gave me a chance to kind of categorize people in more nuanced ways, because people aren't just... you can't just describe people by their politics or where they were born. I think this almost a humanitarian book. It's kind of it's a silly light humor book, but at the same time, I think hopefully what will resonate with it is the fact that I actually really appreciate the nuance of people's personalities.
And as bad as, I guess, and as strange as some of these personalities are, you wouldn't want to live in a world without them.
No, no. I think that's what makes things interesting. That's what makes going to work interesting. That's what makes shopping interesting or going to family reunions. It's just, it's all about the people that you encounter. If everybody was exactly the same, then it'd be a very boring world.
So give us that website again where
it's
people
called
can...
foodcourtdruids.com. So if you have any ideas for your own classification, you can submit them and post them right there.
That was Robert Lanham, author of Food Court Druids, Cherahonkies, and Other Creatures Unique to the Republic. It's published by Plume Books. Still to come on the program, we visit a small candy kitchen in Galena, run by a second-generation candy maker, and we find out what toys made it in this year to the Toy Hall of Fame. Stay tuned. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Where do toys go when they've proven their legendary status? The same place star athletes go, the Hall of Fame. The Strong Museum is a children's museum in Rochester, New York, that houses one of the world's largest collection of toys and dolls. So not surprisingly, it also houses the National Toy Hall of Fame. Each year, the museum evaluates the world of toys and picks those that have achieved lasting adoration. In other words, the Christmas gifts most likely to still be in use when the next Christmas rolls around. This year's inductees, the board game Scrabble, the rocking horse, and one of the newest Hall of Fame toys, G.I. Joe. Tom Rogers talked with Strong Museum spokeswoman Susan Trian.
What separates, you know, the wheat from the chaff, the really classic toys from what you say, the things that may be fads or we may not remember 30, 40 years from our childhood?
Well, we have actually some criteria that we go by in order to select a toy, and they have to fit at least one, if not all, of these. And one is icon status, which means the toy is widely recognized, respected, and remembered. The other is longevity, which means it's more than a passing fad and has enjoyed popularity over many generations. And it has to discovery is the other, which means the toy has to foster learning, creativity, or discovery through play. And innovation, which is that the toy has profoundly changed play or toy design. So, now we have everything from Checkers to now G.I. Joe. So it's a wide net that we're casting out here.
So tell me what got this year's nominees into the hall.
What got this? Well, I can tell you G.I. Joe has been kind of loved and hated over the years, but he is a tremendous icon of American culture, and no one can deny that. And one of the reasons that he got in this year was because of his innovative nature. He was the first action toy. When he was invented in 1964, he's 40 years old, by the way, there was no such thing as an action figure. And Hasbro was trying to figure out how to get boys, frankly, to play with dolls. So they came up with G.I. Joe, which was a tremendous innovation. Now there are action figures, you know, all kinds of spin-offs of Joe, but he was truly the first. So the reason he got in this year, well, first there's a dearth of male figures in our hall. Sad to say, Raggedy Ann is in there, mm-hmm. and there's no Andy. And a Barbie's in there, and there's no Ken. So I think it's time G.I. Joe got in there. We need a little testosterone in our...
So was G.I. Joe not a unanimous choice then?
None of them were actually unanimous. They were tallied, and I don't have the exact results here, but the top, you know, they tally them up, the top one, two, three, you know, up to, there were 12 nominees, so, and they have to give a little kind of dissertation. Why do you think they deserve to get in? And so there has to be a little deep thinking about these toys.
But there are no mobs of protesters outside the museum for G.I. Joe, so I guess you've done a good job.
and on the contrary, I have been delighted to have been contacted. Actually, a Japanese television station just contacted me yesterday. They may be flying up to do a piece.
No kidding.
So it's been kind of spreading like wildfire. And he seems to capture the imagination. We've had also the rocking horse.
Now, that's something that, I mean, G.I. Joe is only about 50 years old. Rocking horses have been around forever and ever.
Right. Rocking horses are just in virtually every person's nursery has a rocking horse. And it's been around for 4,000 years. There's been, you know, horses and figures and children's toys and likenesses of horses. But since the 16th century, the rocking horse has become a staple in many nurseries. And, of course, Scrabble.
I was going to say, you've got at least one other board game on, Monopoly, and now you've got Scrabble, too.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Scrabble is a great mind stretcher. It's who doesn't have a Scrabble set? So those are the three this year, and there are, you know, others in the field that are waiting to get in.
So can you name any of those right now?
Well, I can tell you the, let me see, what were the nominees this year? I didn't memorize the list, but Cabbage Patch Kids certainly, you know, is something. The Wiffle Ball, people I know are clamoring to get the Wiffle Ball in. Everyone's rooting for the toy that they love and that means the most to them and has a childhood memory attached to it. If you have a toy that you love and you feel really must get into that hall, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us through our website or mail in your nomination, and we'll certainly consider it for next year because it's always next year.
Susan Trion is with the Strong Museum in Rochester, New York, the home of the National Toy Hall of Fame. She spoke with AM580's Tom Rogers. A group of historians and other experts sorts through the Hall of Fame suggestions, which you can add to by going to their website, www.strongmuseum.org. You're listening to Sidetrack. In this gift-buying season, Bill Hammack is studying a subdiscipline of engineering that fascinates him. Packaging.
A good package blends technical know-how and psychology. The engineer must understand the chemistry between, say, orange juice and its coated cardboard package, but must also grasp the emotional chemistry between the package and the consumer. In Japan, for example, fish cakes come wrapped in paper that looks like traditional handmade leaves, yet it sports a barcode. The granddaddy of all packagers is Gail Borden. Milk springs to mind when I mention Borden, which just shows how successful he was. He became interested in packaging food to make it portable after hearing in 1846 of the Donner Party. While traveling west, they became trapped by snow. Only 47% of the original 87 survived, and they did so by eating the others. This gruesome tragedy stirred Borden to action. He first tried to condense the essence of meat into a biscuit. It took 6 years and $60,000 to develop, but failed because it was unsightly and unpalatable. But the idea of condensing fascinated Borden. He advised his pastor to condense your sermons. He told lovers to no longer write poetry, but to condense all they have to say into a kiss. And he suggested you spend as little time as possible at a meal. He was always done in 15 minutes. Borden's next attempt at food packaging came while on an ocean voyage to London. The ship's seasick cows couldn't be milked, so the ship filled with the cries of hungry infants, which spurred him to invent condensed milk. Although experts told him it wouldn't work, Borden put some in a vacuum pan and boiled it. It failed, just as the experts predicted, because it stuck to the pan. Being less knowledgeable than the experts, Borden simply greased the pan and it worked fine to make condensed milk. He canned the product, selling it with the promise of all good packaging, a sanitary and safe product. Borden's condensed milk took off with the Civil War because soldiers needed portable rations. In fact, wars are often the stimulus for a quantum leap in packaging. From World War I emerged cellophane. It was used for gas mask lenses. After the war, packagers used cellophane to wrap and display goods. Then World War II sparked our current state of packaging by making America excel in plastics. Saran wrap, for example, started in the war as a film to protect aircraft engines from water. And eventually, World War II soldiers had plastic canteens and containers to protect ammo, and they carried rations in plastic or foil pouches. Plastics were not the only innovation from World War II. It also introduced, of course, the nuclear age. I hope for humanity's sake that this new type of war never makes for a packaging revolution.
The comments of Bill Hammack, who teaches chemical engineering at the University of Illinois. His essays on engineering and life can be found on the web at engineerguy.com. This is Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. Just in time for Christmas, a Midwestern publisher has released what could be the last word on one type of farm equipment. Weighing 8 pounds and measuring 11 by 12 inches, the coffee table book is called John Deere, A History of the Tractor. Herb Trix reports.
John Deere, A History of the Tractor, is the latest in a long line of books on tractors and farm machinery by an unlikely author, Randy Leffingwell.
My publisher approached me with this, with the idea of the first tractor book I ever did about 14 years ago. I was working on another project. We found out another publisher had a similar book title coming. And Tim Parker, who's an Englishman, looked at me and said, I say, Randy, have you ever thought about farm tractors? I'm a city kid. I grew up in the Chicago suburbs. I knew they still made farm tractors, but I had never thought about them. But being the sensible man that I was, I didn't dismiss the idea out of hand. I said, you know, I haven't thought about them, but let me think about them. And that has led to, probably 15 books on farm tractors now, and it's a subject that absolutely fascinates me.
Leffingwell has written and photographed books on Cat, Deere, IH, and Ford tractors already, plus some general histories on developments in engineering. But he got the idea for the newest book about 3 years ago, when he learned that the chief engineer for Deere from 1913 to 1953, Theo Brown, had kept a detailed diary. Deere required its engineers to keep a diary so it could keep track of engineering developments and patents. But Brown did more than that.
He recorded the weather. He recorded the current events in Moline and in the world. As the Great Depression came on, he had comments about banks folding and farm foreclosure auctions and the horrible tragedies that were befalling the farmers that he had met working on the project he was doing. World War II came on, and he literally reproduced newspaper headlines into his diaries.
Leffingwell says that became the foundation for this new book on Deere tractors.
From its first efforts with Minneapolis Threshing Machine Company's tractors, which Deere provided plows for and then also arranged through brokers to sell the tractors to farmers, through the creation of the Dane Deere all-wheel drive prototypes, through the acquisition of Waterloo Boy, into the creation of the Model D, and then on through the rest of history, finally bringing the book to a close with Deere's assumption of the number one sales position in the world, and then on into the latest generation of tractors, including the rubber-belted track models.
And at nearly 400 pages, he calls the large book a lavish and luxurious history.
It is truly a blend of history and coffee table book, because I visited 40 tractor collectors across the country. I did two long road trips over the last couple of years, put about 13,000 miles on my car, and photographed probably 100 tractors for this book, always trying to find settings that seemed appropriate to farming.
For this book, he took his own photographs and combined them with photos and drawings from Brown's diary and the Deere archives. So after 15 books, what's left to cover when it comes to tractors? Leffingwell is now working on a similar book about farmall tractors. It should be released next year at about this time.
There is a period of time when the farmall name disappeared. In fact, International stopped using the name farmall in the 70s for a while. And by 1984, when they had pretty much concluded they weren't going to be able to make it, and Case took them over, the international tractor designs continued, but under the Case IH logo. And interestingly, perhaps in a bid to kind of tweak the nostalgia that a lot of farmers still recognize, CNH, now the parent company, has reintroduced the Farmall brand with a completely new line of small tractors and medium-sized tractors this fall.
And he admits his former colleagues at the Los Angeles Times are still amazed at his new career chronicling mechanized agriculture, but keenly interested in each new book.
Many of them come from the Midwest. Many of them have roots in agricultural communities, and a lot of the books that I get from the publishers, I have an A-list of friends who get signed copies from me, and a number of them are former LA Times or current LA Times staffers who look at these things and say, you know, my grandfather ran one of those.
Randy Leffingwell, author of John Deere, A History of the Tractor. It's published by MBI Publishing in St. Paul, Minnesota, and should be available at most major bookstores for about $50. I'm Herb Trix.
You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Just imagine a store filled with candy, all kinds, the ones you remember from your childhood, in bins, and the scent of fudge being prepared. All this is at the Candy Kitchen in Galena. George Paxton created this candy store in 1974. Jiffy Johnson visited him recently and asked him to trace his family's roots in candy making.
My father started making candy in 1902. That was in St. Joe, Missouri, and he stayed there for about 8 years. And in 1910, he moved to Chicago. While he was in St. Joe, he worked for four different companies, candy companies, as a helper. And he realized that if he wanted to really expand on his knowledge, that he would have to come to Chicago, where there were more companies. In those days, they learned by looking over the candy maker's shoulder.
Sort of an apprentice kind of situation?
Well, the regular candy makers were very hesitant about sharing too much information because they didn't want to jeopardize their own jobs. And so he learned by looking over their shoulders and later on writing down what he learned, the weights and everything.
And eventually this led to the creation of a very famous candy.
Yes. I think I was probably 7 or 8 years old at the time, in about 1937. And I can still remember him bringing home a little white box, and in that box were these Chuckles, but they were a different shape originally. They were like the shape of a mound. I remember at that age, I was excited because I got a chance to eat some candy.
But was it called Chuckles from the get-go?
Well, he worked for a fellow by the name of Fred Ammond. When he developed this piece of candy, Fred Ammond took it home to his wife. And she tasted it, and when she tasted it, she kind of chuckled a little bit. And because she knew that that's what he was looking for. And that's how it's got its name. They said, well, we'll call it Chuckles.
Now, they're fruit-flavored, right?
Right.
How do you describe them to someone who's never had a Chuckles?
Well, it's a jelly. They come in five different flavors. They used to be very popular in movie theaters. My dad always said, though, later on in life, that they changed the recipe and they weren't as good as when he first developed them, you know. And he always took pride in the fact that back in those days, they used very basic ingredients, but then after that, there's a lot of substitutes now that they use for preservation and stuff, you know, so.
Is that a family recipe that you can make now?
That is a recipe that was patented by Fred Ammond. And in fact, after that candy was developed, a lot of other candy companies wanted the recipe. And my dad used to tell a story about a fellow that worked for another candy company, and this fellow came and applied for a job with Fred Ammond. He got the job, And his whole sole purpose was to try to get that recipe.
When you were 7 years old, you sampled the Chuckles. Now, did you get a steady diet of his Chuckles after that?
No. My folks, every year around Christmas time, they would make small batches of candy in their home. I can still remember that. Mm-hmm. Every year they get orders from people at the church, and they would make chocolate creams. And those were what I really loved, the chocolate creams, you know. But I can still remember him making a small batch of fondant and then rolling the fondant in little balls and throwing them in a puddle of chocolate. Mm-hmm. And my mother would dip the fondant in chocolate.
And this was done at home, but he was also commercially in the business still the rest of his life?
He was working in the candy business into his 80s. He actually retired earlier than that, but some company hired him as a consultant, and he worked for that person for quite a few years, you know.
Did you become a candy maker at the outset of your adulthood?
I never dreamed that I would be making candy. In Chicago, I was a computer systems analyst. I was around 44 years old, and that was 30 years ago, when I decided that I just wanted to get out of the big city, and I was tired of the calls in the middle of the night working in the computer business. My family came out to Galena, and we were looking at the shops, and at that time, Galena was a lot of old antique stores and bars. Just happened to walk by a real estate office, and there was a sign in the window that this pulley was for sale. At that time, you could have bought any building on Main Street for like between $20,000 and $30,000. And so we put an offer in on this building on the spur of the moment, and we decided that if things went well, and we could sell our house back in Chicago, and there were no stumbling blocks, that we'd continue, you know. Everything just worked. We sold our house the very first day that we put it on the market.
There was a message there.
Well, we were acting kind of like it was a providential type thing. Mm-hmm.
Was this building then actually, did it have a candy shop in it at the time?
No, this building, as I recall, there was a art studio in here at the time.
In Galena, now that you've gone into the candy business, what do you provide that's most popular?
Well, I think our Georgies are probably very popular. My name is George. That's how it got its name. But the Georgies is a turtle. The turtle is a franchise name, so we just got to change the name of it. But I think they're very good, you know.
Who helps you with all this?
Well, when I first started out, actually, I did everything myself. I would come here on weekends from Chicago. I still had my job back in Chicago. And I would work on the store here, you know. And then I would go back on Sunday. And I was so excited about this project that it was almost like a compulsion with me at the time. I just had to try it, you know.
I think I smell fudge in the making, and I see Melissa Edelman is helping you. Melissa, can you show me how you're making this fudge?
Well, it's basic ingredients. You start with heavy cream, pure cane sugar, make it in a copper kettle the old-fashioned way.
And we're not talking about a small copper kettle here.
No, it's very large. It makes approximately 60 pounds a batch. Yeah.
The kettle itself is, as long as my arm, wide.
Well, luckily, I don't have to lift this kettle. I start in a smaller kettle, and everything ends up in the big kettle, and I have a lifter for it, and it dumps out onto the pans for me.
So now what are you making here?
This is all ingredients that is added to the fudge later on. It's a very slow process. You start off cooking it. Nice even temperature. Takes about 3 hours altogether. All the ingredients we put into the fudge we make from scratch also, like the fondant, mazetta, it's all made from scratch here.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to mix this with?
With my fudge mix over here. Everything is, you do it according to temperature, so it takes a while. You have to wait till it hits a certain degrees, and then you add the fondant, which is a homemade ingredient, and then I'll add my mazetta later and then stir
it
all up.
What's mazetta?
Mazetta is a different form of sugar also. Mm-hmm. So everything is different forms of sugar put into the same pot.
You have a monster thermometer here, which you can read very easily. Even I can read this at a distance.
Yeah, we like to be very accurate and have our batches come out the same every time. So we use, But this is only my 9th month here doing the candy for George, but he's taught me very well. So
So you think there's a future for you here?
I hope so. I really enjoy it here. It's like a big family.
Do you think that you might go into candy making?
Well, hopefully I can work for George as long as he'd like me to. And then that would be something to think about, yeah. I enjoy it very much, though. It's fun work.
Diane Paxton is George's wife. And how long have you been part of this candy mania?
Since 1988, I think, 88, 89.
Mm-hmm. Do you have to have a sweet tooth to do this?
Not really. But it's bad if you do.
What do the customers particularly like about the work that you've created here?
Well, they like the fact that everything is homemade from scratch, and the Georgies, which is our number one seller. And usually when we get people in, they love to watch someone do the dipping. When we do the school tours or tours with senior citizens, we usually have someone on the dipping machine, and George used to give the history of how chocolate was made and everything, and they all seem to enjoy that.
My intention was to come up with an old-fashioned store, you know. So originally we sold cheeses and sausages, and I made an old-fashioned hot dog wagon that we sold hot dogs out of, and a big root beer barrel. And it was sort of like a general type store, a country store. And I got that idea from a place in Long Grove, Illinois, that used to have that same type of shop. So that's how it started out. But then we got an ice cream parlor in town, we got a cheese shop in town, and so we just gradually switched over to all candy.
Well, people who buy candy are usually pretty happy about the process of buying the candy.
Yeah. And the thing about candy is my dad used to tell a story about wanting to work in a bakery. That was his original thought. But when he found out that he had to get up so early in the morning, he thought maybe candy would be a better thing. Candy, you can give two people the same formula. You don't call them candy, you don't call them recipes or formulas. And the chances are that both candy makers will come up with a different product, you know, because there's so many variables. Mm-hmm. The timing, how much the batch is cool before you add something to it. And especially in chocolate dipping, chocolate is very temperamental. So the chocolate has to be tempered just right before you can use it to dip, you know. Mm-hmm. It gives you a special sense of satisfaction when you're able to do these things successfully. Mm-hmm. When I first came to Galena, well, the very first day that we opened, I decided that I was going to make a particular kind of candy, and I think it was peanut brittle. And I remember back in Chicago when I was learning all of this, I wrote everything down because I had been a systems analyst, you know, and I thought, well, all I got to do is write down the procedures and everything's going to be fine. Well, the very first batch of candy I made, I burned, and the whole store was full of smoke. So I immediately called my dad, and he came out to Galena, and we worked together for a couple of weeks.
You discovered you needed your father's help.
Yeah, right. I think that made him feel good. Didn't make me feel too good, though.
So he actually got to see this facility and participate.
He used to love to come to Galena. Yeah. He came from St. Joe, Missouri. But at that time, that wasn't it was a pretty big city. But he wanted to get away from Chicago. And so Galena was a small town. He loved it.
George Paxton is owner of the Candy Kitchen in Galena on Main Street. Reporting from Galena, I'm Jiffy Johnson.
Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL Urbana.